Back in 1965, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King delivered the eulogy for Unitarian Universalist minister Reverend James Reeb. Reverend Reeb had died a few days earlier in Selma, Alabama, on the night of the aborted march to Montgomery, the march that famously began on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Dr. King wrote, "In his death, James Reeb says something to each of us, black and white alike, says that we must substitute courage for caution, says that we must be concerned not merely about who murdered him, but about the system, the way of life, the philosophy which produced the murder. His death says to us that we must work passionately, unrelentingly, to make the American dream a reality, so that he did not die in vain." That was 1965. In 2017, Unitarian Universalism experienced a watershed moment around race. For the last 50 years, we UUs have been patting ourselves on the back about our history, first for our work in the abolition of slavery, and then our role in the civil rights movement. I should point out, however, that that wasn't the whole story. For example, while we were a fairly diverse denomination in the 1960s, our denomination reneged on some promises that we made to our African American members at that time. And black people left our churches in droves. And then last year happened. Our association was accused from within of fostering white supremacy. What? Unitarian Universalists accused of white supremacy? We could hardly be compared to the Klan or to neo-Nazis, could we? Could they really be talking about us? I personally struggled with those questions and the entire situation. It took me a while before I was able to recognize what the people of color in our association were talking about. Honestly, the issue of race and racism has humbled me over and over again. Every time I think I know something, new information comes to light, and I realize that I have so much more to learn. But at least last year I had the good sense to listen and learn. Today, as we honor the weekend of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King's birthday, I'd like to share with you some of what I have learned thus far. About 8 years ago, I took a workshop with Reverend Dr. Monica Cummings, who was then with the Unitarian Universalist Association in Boston, head of the Youth and Young Adult of Color. She has her PhD in racial identity formation. At the end of the workshop, Dr. Cummings asked us to make further commitments to combat racial injustice. So I made a commitment to do some reading and to preach about race. The first thing I did was to read a book by UU theologian Dr. Tandeka called Learning to Be White. And coincidentally, when I told my oldest sister that I intended to preach on racism, she told me this story, one that intersects well with Reverend Tandeka's theories. When I was 2 years old and my sister was 11, our family moved to Indonesia from Fairview, New Jersey, a very segregated town. My sister had an Indonesian friend, a boy who lived down the street. For a while, they were pre-adolescent boyfriend and girlfriend, so of course that didn't last. But a couple of years later, this boy and another Anglo girl became an item, and the girl's father was outraged. He forbade the relationship. This was part of the girl's and my sister's education in whiteness. When these events occur, The child is torn between her own feelings and those of her parents. Most usually, the child will obey her parents, the source of love and nurture. But Reverend Tandaka says that something inside the child has been damaged, and this damage causes a sense of shame that will be carried throughout her life. What's more, these types of choices perpetuate a devastating system of inequality. Whether we're deciding to live in a white part of town, or sending a child to private school, or choosing to ignore the implications of so many other racially tinged situations in our lives. Whether diverse communities are kept apart by families, through police enforcement and threat of violence, or by other means, the lesson is the same. And I learned that in the United States, this kind of segregation didn't just grow up by happenstance. As I read Reverend Tandaka's book, I learned that the landed gentry in our country didn't only import African slaves, they also imported white European indentured servants. The landowners soon learned, however, that even though African slaves were initially more costly to purchase, they were better, if you will, long-term investment. One reason was that unlike the African slaves, the European indentured servants became free after a number of years of service. Another factor, she says, was that white Europeans died in great numbers. She quotes an astonishing statistic that 80% died within 3 years of arriving here. So increasing numbers of Africans were purchased, and the indentured servants and the slaves worked side by side in the fields. Initially, both groups were treated alike. They were both corrected by their masters with whips. Both were underfed and clothed in worn-out garments. But the term of indenture was fixed, and so the indentured servants became free. But most remained where they were, nothing more than hired labor. They would never have land of their own. They saw no future for themselves. In 1676, Bacon's Rebellion, black and white joined together in an uprising in the Virginia colony against the ruling class. That was the first time that poor whites and poor blacks were united in a common cause. A similar uprising happened in Maryland. The landowners saw this and began to fear the strength and power that a united underclass could muster. They feared that whites and blacks would find more reasons to join in common cause. However, they saw an opportunity. They realized that there was a way to drive a wedge between the two groups without losing too much of their power. So they got laws passed that allowed a few privileges for the poor whites. Not enough to threaten the landowners' wealth and hold on power, just enough to make the freed whites feel different from the Africans. Tandaka cites several laws that were passed shortly following the two rebellions. The Virginia Assembly forbade freed Negroes and Indians from owning Christian, that is, white servants. White Christians were granted the right to give any Negro or other slave who dared lift their hand in opposition to a Christian 30 lashes on the bare back. Masters were forbidden to whip a Christian white servant naked because nakedness was for brutes, Indians and Africans. Then a law decreed that all property, horses, cattle, and hogs, was to be confiscated from the slaves and sold by church wardens, and who would benefit? The poor whites. Furthermore, people of African descent were legally barred from the skilled trades. Social historian Edmund Morgan, writing about this period, says that the ruling elite of Virginia initially raised the legal status of lower class whites compared to that of Negroes and Indians. For example, in 1705, the Virginia Assembly required masters to provide white servants at the end of their indentureship with corn, money, a gun, clothing, and 50 acres of land. As a result of such legal changes, to quote Morgan, white men gained legal, political, emotional, social, and financial status that was directly related to the degradation of Indians and Negroes. These Virginia laws became the model for other southern colonies. Before these laws were passed, people of all colors shared a similar life. They worked and played and even loved together. But now, poor whites found themselves granted just enough privilege that they actually began to identify with the white upper class rather than with the Africans who had been their peers. They felt superior because legally they were. And within one generation, Southern whites were refusing to work side by side with African slaves. I believe that this identification persists to this day. Why, I ask myself, at every election, do lower and middle class whites vote against their own interest when policies of the more diverse political party would benefit them? We are still imagining or aspiring to a social status, one of wealth and power, that very few of us will ever attain. We feel that we need to keep up with the Joneses while we identify with the Vanderbilts. And it causes many of us to act against our own interests. Divide and conquer. That was the idea. It has been, and it still is, a very successful strategy. Those in power have been keeping us separated, both as groups and individuals. Part of the genius of Dr. King was that he was able to both galvanize a black movement and break into the moral consciousness of white America and help us join together again in common cause. I continued my education by attending a presentation by Douglas Blackman, a Wall Street Journal writer. He talked about his book, The Re-Enslavement of Black Americans. In that book, Mr. Blackman documents the mind-boggling fact that well after Lincoln, African Americans in the South were arrested for minor offenses like loitering and served their prison sentences far from home as factory workers, miners, and in lumber camps, often in inhumane conditions. He documents that their sentences were often life sentences. These men were held in camps and practically starved to death, clothed in rags, had no contact with their families, and no legal recourse. Was this a foreshadowing of our mass incarceration and prison industrial complex? Trayvon Martin, killed by vigilante George Zimmerman, followed by Tamir Rice, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, Sandra Bland, Philando Castile, and Alton Sterling, all killed either by police or in police custody. Those deaths sparked demonstrations, and acts of resistance. With those deaths so public, we could no longer doubt what our black and brown brothers and sisters have been telling us for years. We quickly responded with Black Lives Matter banners, buttons, and bracelets. Welcome signs of solidarity, but they fall far short of what is needed to dismantle, as Michelle Alexander writes in her book, The New Jim Crow, a racial caste system, a tightly networked system of customs, institutions, laws, and policies that operate collectively to ensure the subordinate status of a group largely defined by race. To sustain this system, the ruling class need only racial indifference, as Martin Luther King Jr. warned more than 45 years ago. Alexander continues, "New consensus must begin with dialogue, a conversation that fosters a critical consciousness, a key prerequisite to effective action. We must re-examine our basic assumptions about the role of the criminal justice system in our society. More than half the young black men in many large American cities are currently under the control of the criminal justice system or saddled with criminal records. Is not, as many argue, just a symptom of poverty and poor choices, but rather evidence of a new racial caste system at work." Sharon Welsh in The Feminist Ethic of Risk taught me some years ago that while white people have the option to be unconscious about race as we go about our daily life, that people of color have no such luxury. They have to be on guard against any unconscious remark, unintended insult, or worse. That's called microaggression. People of color have to struggle and fight for things that white people take for granted. That's white privilege. The whole structure is white supremacy. And so ethical white people must remain at the table and in the conversation, even when it's heated, even when it's uncomfortable, even when we are wrong and it is pointed out to us. Robin DiAngelo, PhD, has coined a term, white fragility. She says that white people in North America live in a social environment that protects and insulates them from race-based stress. This insulated environment of racial protection builds white expectations for comfort, while at the same time lowering their ability to tolerate racial stress. White fragility is a state in which even a minimum amount of racial stress becomes intolerable, triggering a range of defensive moves. These moves include the outward display of emotions, such as anger, fear, and guilt, and behaviors such as argumentation, silence, or leaving the stress-induced situation. These behaviors, in turn, function to reinstate white racial equilibrium. Looking at all of this, the pain, the shame, the guilt, the frustration, the anger, all the deep-seated, entrenched problems that it has caused, I know that I have to grow. I know that I have to move from white fragility to moral courage and soul. What I'm realizing is that we all have to find common cause again. We have to focus on the places in our society that we all, every one of us, want fixed. Education, healthcare, jobs, the criminal justice system, the environment. If this is a radical idea, It's because we are being forced apart at every turn, in every way. We are red or blue. We are for single payer or free enterprise. We are pro-choice or pro-life. And it isn't even those kinds of polarizing political conflicts that keep us apart. It's infighting with people who agree with us politically, morally, and socially. Just read the comments on any liberal website if you really want to get upset. We should be making common cause, not fighting among ourselves. If there is any good news in all of this, it's that a system that has been constructed can be dismantled. I can see a few things that might be useful. First, we can do personal work. You could start by taking the workshop that the racial justice team will offer later this year. We can take part in multiracial community organizing from a base of power like ICO right here in Long Beach. We can join them in organizing efforts starting now for the fall election. We can spiritually resist the impulse to be driven apart. Remaining together is difficult spiritual work when forces are amassed against it. But I know that I need my religious community because here it is safe to try. And if and when I will surely fall short, there is a community that helps me face my shortcomings and then regenerates the energy and the moral fiber to continue the work. Did you know that Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism are advocating for an eighth UUA principle? It reads, "We, the member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenant to affirm and promote journeying toward spiritual wholeness by working to build a diverse, multicultural, beloved community by our actions that accountably dismantle racism and other oppressions in our lives and our institutions." So our religious community continues to challenge us to heal from America's original sin. Finally, I have been deeply inspired by the work of Reverend Dr. William Barber, former head of the NAACP in North Carolina. He's been calling for nothing less than a moral revolution in our country. He said, "Following moral traditions rooted in our faith and the Constitution, we are called to stand up for justice and to tell the truth. We challenge the position that the preeminent moral issues of today are about prayer in public school, abortion, and homosexuality. Instead, we declare the deepest public concerns of our faith traditions are how our society treats the poor, those on the margins, and the least of these, women, children, workers, immigrants, and the sick. Equality and representation under the law, and the desire for peace, love, and harmony within and among nations." Barber has a vision of something that he calls fusion politics, seeking to transcend left and right, Republican and Democrat. He says that if instead of those labels, we join together around a morality-based progressive agenda. In other words, if we can get to the moral root of the issues and highlight our shared values, that we can move our country forward to higher ground. He says we grow stronger in our work together as we embrace these things that we most deeply believe in, standing together where our values unite us, and learning to respect one another where our traditions differ. His prophetic voice has the power to help us create an interconnected web of love here in our sanctuaries for each other, and a foundation of social justice out in the streets. We are stronger together. There is much work to be done, but there is also faith, hope, and love. What could better answer Dr. King's question, where do we go from here?